At this time, oral argument in the case of Marie Graves versus DJO LLC. Panel that you will have hearing it today will be consisting of myself, Justice Wade Birdwell, to my left, Justice Mike Wallach, and I've already broken protocol because he's the youngster on this panel, and to my right, Justice Dabney Basil. I'm assuming we have a new contraption up here with regard to time that I have not yet seen. Justice Basil has. I'm not sure Justice Wallach has seen it. So it scares me a little bit, but we'll see if we can work through it anyway. Would you go ahead and announce ready?
The court will now call Maria Graves versus DJO LLC. May it please the court, Mr. Alvin Gomez will argue for the appellant. Ms. Elizabeth Doji will argue for the appellate.
All righty, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Alvin Gomez on behalf of the appellant. I thank the court for allowing me to appear for advice to argue before your justices. This is a case, Your Honor, that really focuses on one salient issue, whether or not Maria Graves waived her special appearance by filing a motion for sanctions under the rules 1000.001 and 004. And it's our position that the controlling case in this matter is Brady versus Kane, which was decided in April 28, 2020. And in that case, the appellate court found that there was no waiver of jurisdiction with regard to a motion for sanctions. And that's a very broad language, but in this case, the motion for sanctions that was brought was totally tied into the motion for special appearance. In order for the rules to have teeth, meaning the Civil Practice and Remedies Code 10.001 and 0.004 to have teeth, there has to be some type of recourse on a procedural basis to allow a party to bring a motion for sanctions as a result of a frivolous pleading or filing by a plaintiff.
But is that not a statutory remedy that requires a request for affirmative relief?
No, it doesn't require a request for affirmative relief. The reason it doesn't is because the statute within itself defines the terms of what has to be established. It's based upon the conduct of the, in this case, the claimant. And so the court has to analyze the conduct of the claimant in bringing a pleading that was subject to a special notice. And so in this case, we filed our special notice and the court granted that. And it was that basis where the court made the determination that there was no jurisdiction. And so in order for any party or attorney to have recourse against them with regard to a statute that specifically says that the pleading or motion is not being presented for any improper purpose, including to harass or to cause unnecessary delay or needless increase in the cost of litigation. And so under their scenario, in the cases that they argue, what would happen then is there would be no recourse. So any litigant can bring an action in Texas court, and it's not subject to Rule 10 because under
what's
that scenario.
What's the difference between recourse and relief?
Well,
you're arguing that recourse should be available under Chapter 10
yes.
Under the circumstances and therefore no waiver, without any waiver. But the case law is pretty clear that once you ask the court that you have denied has personal jurisdiction over you for relief, that can constitute a waiver. So what are you proposing as a manner by which we can make a distinction between recourse, as you're referring to it in Chapter 10, and relief, as our case law and other case law has said, constitutes a waiver?
I think the court can look at the analysis that was done by Brady versus Kane. In that court, in that situation, the court went through the similar analysis and made a determination that the motion for sanctions did not act as an affirmative remedy, but it was tied into the special appearance. In this case, the special appearance and the recourse we're seeking is tied specifically into that special notice. Otherwise, what the courts would be saying is, it's okay, we could trick people in the jurisdiction by saying you have no recourse in the event someone files a false pleading under Section 10. And that's the problem, is from a public policy standpoint, what a party can do is try to create the invocation of jurisdiction by saying, we're gonna sue you in Texas court, even though we know we don't have a factual or legal basis to do so. And you bring your special motion, and it's granted. And at that point, it would stop. And so what's the purpose of Section 10 if a person is not allowed recourse to seek sanctions as a result of the conduct of the person who files a pleading that is subject to the special notice? That's the problem. And so we have to look to history. We have to look at public policy. And in this case, public policy is very important to establish that, no, there is a place for this statute. Otherwise, Section 10 has no teeth whatsoever, because it will allow any litigant to do what they want and not be subject to the sanctions of the court. And if they do, then the court's going to sit there and say, well, you've submitted the general jurisdiction, which isn't fair. It doesn't provide the party with the same remedy, a recourse, that it would any other person. And so I think we have two comparisons. One, where the person has a right for recourse under Section 10. And another one, a person doesn't have any right for recourse under Section 10. And that's not the purpose of the statute. The purpose of the statute is to be applied equally and fairly for all parties and all litigants, and they have the right to pursue that remedy and recourse based upon the Section 10 filing. And so what's interesting is when we look at the cases and some of the things that were stated, and when we look at the Supreme Court ruling under Exito, you know, Exito talks about specifics, cases in which they were allowed to negate the special notice. And one of the things that that's very interesting is, I quote, "It is simply illogical to allow the parties to engage in relevant discovery, which can be a vital part of the resolving a special appearance, but prohibit the non-resident defender from seeking the trial court's ruling on disputes that may affect the evidence presented at the special appearance hearing. And applying the Dawson-Austin framework, a non-resident defendant's participation in the trial court's resolution of such discovery matters does not amount to recognition that the action is properly pending or a request for affirmative relief inconsistent with the jurisdictional challenges." And so what's important about that and what it says is, in this case, we have the recourse statute that we're tying into the special appearance. And so the Supreme Court in Exito does allow that to happen. And there's no specific case that says under rules, under Section 10, that you waive jurisdiction by bringing a rule Section 10 motion. There's no case whatsoever. This is a case of first impression with regard to Section 10 and the special appearance. The case that they cite, Composite, that had to do with seeking declaratory relief, sanctions and attorney's fees under declaratory relief. We weren't seeking declaratory relief. We were relying on a specific statute with regard to affirmative conduct on the part of a separate cause of action.
Wasn't that a little bit more distinct, though? That was a situation where they had challenged personal jurisdiction and against a DEC action. And therefore, once they succeeded with regard to the dismissal, they then, considering themselves to be a prevailing party, sought attorney's fees under Chapter 37 as a prevailing party, having prevailed on the dismissal for want of personal jurisdiction. So why is here it appears to be the same thing, does it not?
The reason it's not the same thing is they acknowledged that the court had jurisdiction. We've never acknowledged the court had jurisdiction. We filed our special notice, our special appearance.
Well, but they did that by saying that we're going to seek relief under the very statute that we thought or we argued was without application to us based upon personal jurisdiction. Here, the argument's being made not, it's distinct. We're trying to figure out what distinction to make of that since we're bound by composite, okay? But are they not doing this, are you not doing essentially the same thing that having prevailed on, originally prevailed on the motion to dismiss the plea against the personal jurisdiction, you now are basically going, oh, well, since we prevailed on that, we should get our attorney's fees because it was groundless and or frivolous. And you're invoking a statute that provides relief. What's the distinction between being a prevailing party under the DEC action, okay, and post-dismissal seeking relief under a statute that you did not evoke, and now invoking a statute that was not a part of the dismissal for affirmative relief with regard to your attorney's fees?
And your last point is very poignant. And the reason it's very poignant is because the DEC relief action in composite was merits-based. It was based upon the statutory scheme that was being sued upon. In this case, we weren't suing for anything on any statutory basis. What we're seeking is recourse based upon a pleading that was filed in violation of Section 10. And so that's a huge distinction. And so in that regard, composite is an opposite. It's opposite to what we're arguing because composite dealt with a statutory scheme where they were suing for a DEC relief action, and they brought attorney's fees pursuing to the DEC relief action, and they submitted to the jurisdiction. Here, we didn't agree to submit to the jurisdiction. Our position all along was the motion under Section 10 was tied into the special appearance. Otherwise, we could never invoke Section 10. Never. No litigant who makes a special appearance can ever, in any case, invoke Section 10. And that's not the purpose of the statute. The purpose of a statute is to make sure that there's a procedural safeguard, and this is what this statute focuses on, procedure. A procedural safeguard that in the event a person files a pleading that they sign in their name, it's subject to recourse of a prevailing party in the special notice of appearance to do that. Otherwise, there's no teeth.
Counsel, exactly what relief are you requesting? Your prayer was a bit vague in that respect from the way I was reading it.
The prayer in this court?
Yes.
Is for the court to reverse the decision that there is no waiver of appearance.
Okay. Are you asking for a remand on the sanctions issue?
No. Okay. No remand on the sanctions issue. I've learned my lesson. That it's not worth the risk to take that because the law is not clear at this point, and I think this court can make the law very clear by saying that Section 10 has to have the ability to be equally applied to all litigants, regardless of a motion for special appearance. Otherwise, you've basically gutted the Section 10 language.
So if we rule in your favor, you're looking for a rendition from us?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. It's a good strategy to keep it a little warm in here. It makes us go a little faster.
No, that part of that is my getting here a little bit late in the day, so sorry about that.
Oh, don't worry.
But it is a little warm.
It is
a little warm.
We'll make you wear the robe too.
Yeah, I was gonna say these bathrobes don't help.
So we may need to look into getting some fans underneath here, you know. All righty, counsel.
Mr. Gomez argued a moment ago that the law is not clear on this issue, and it is our position that the law is very clear, especially as stated in composite cooling. When a party is granted special appearance and the court dismisses their case, and they turn around and go to the same court and ask for monetary relief, that is a request for affirmative relief. They have made a general appearance. So this case is very similar to composite cooling. Yes, it involves a different statute, but the relief that the party is seeking is the same. And Ms. Graves here got what she wanted. She got a grant of her special appearance. She got a finding from the trial court that there was no personal jurisdiction over her. And she turned around and said, yes, but I also would like some money.
So what you're telling us is that if you're opposing a special appearance, you can file whatever you want to, say whatever you want to, and have no accountability whatsoever. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying
that. Then what accountability is there if you can't get it under Section 10? Where can you get it?
Your Honor, that recourse is not available for the party that it's in the circumstances that Ms. Graves is in.
I'm asking you, you say that there is accountability. What is the source of accountability for attorneys and for parties so that they can't just come in here and file frivolous pleadings, if that's what the case is, and have their heyday, and if they lose, so be it?
Two sources, Your Honor, for that accountability. One is all attorneys in Texas are bound by the Texas Lawyer's Creed, and so that governs the filing of the pleadings as well. They have to act ethically. And the second source for accountability is for Ms. Graves to return to the jurisdiction that she argued she belongs in. So you can't have your case.
What relief can she get there for her attorney's fees and expenses for having to assert the special appearance here successfully?
That is for that jurisdiction to decide.
Are you aware of any situation where a California jurisdiction would be able to enforce a Texas jurisdictional offense?
You know, I do not know, but that is not a concern for this
court. There's not an answer for that, okay? But it goes to this one. Is Chapter 10 actually allows the trial court to make a sua sponte finding, okay? And attorney's fees are a remedy that are available for a sua sponte finding under Chapter 10 that the pleading was filed in bad faith or groundless or frivolous, okay? So here, had the trial court made an independent decision based upon, obviously, the plea of privilege or the special appearance, that there was no basis for the jurisdictional assumption or the invocation by your client, the trial court could have awarded sanctions independently under Chapter 10 and could have, as the sanction, awarded those attorney's fees, the exact same attorney's fees, requested information from Ms. Graves as to what her attorney's fees were, and imposed that upon your client. Okay, so if the court could do that under the circumstance here, all right, and presumably if the court does that, Ms. Graves can accept that sanction without waiving jurisdiction. Is why the distinction between she simply making a motion and say, Your Honor, we'd like you to pay attention to this aspect and we would appreciate you taking a look at it and awarding us our attorney's fees? Is it the mere fact that she's the one who initiated the motion that's the waiver?
I actually think in that second portion of your hypothetical where you state that the court, that she could accept that award of sanctions from the Texas court, I don't believe she could. I think that acceptance would be inconsistent with an argument that the court doesn't have personal jurisdiction over her. If you go back to the language of the rule, 120A, it states that the only argument that a party can make related to the personal jurisdiction is challenging that personal jurisdiction. The moment they step outside of that and ask for anything outside of that.
Counselor, that's not completely true. I mean, with Exito and the discovery cases, you can file a motion to compel, you can seek sanctions with the discovery, if the discovery is related to the special appearance. And it appears the general principle is whether or not you're recognizing the action is properly pending. If you seek sanctions for a failure to respond to discovery directed to the special appearance, you're not making that recognition. So how does his motion in this case suggest a recognition that the matter was properly pending in a Texas court?
Your Honor, Rule 128 has a special carve-out for discovery disputes. So the cases that are applying Rule 128 and looking at the personal jurisdiction waiver in that context are looking at that carve-out. There's no carve-out in Rule 128 for a motion for sanctions, especially one filed after the court had already ruled that there is no personal jurisdiction. That's what makes this case so unique and so similar to Composite Cooling, is that the court had already granted her the relief she was seeking. The court had already found there was no personal jurisdiction over her. And she turned around and asked for a different type of relief.
Forgive me, I should know this, but I'm not recalling it at this point in time. Did she file an independent motion, or was it part of a response to your motion for new trial?
She filed two independent motions for sanctions, twice, in response to different orders dismissing the case. You remember the case was dismissed. Why?
Originally dismissed, and then it was dismissed with prejudice. I mean, it was first dismissed with prejudice, then that was corrected as part of, there have been two or three motions for new trial in the middle of all of that. And so you're asking for a distinction here, and 10 applies not just to pleadings, it applies to motions as well. So my question is, was her request for sanctions under Chapter 9 in response solely to the pleading, the jurisdictional pleading, as being groundless, or was it also in response to the fact that y'all filed a motion for new trial on top of that?
So the motion is written challenged both. It said it was a groundless petition and it was a groundless motion for new trial. But during the argument on that motion in front of Judge Johnson, they've dropped the second argument and only challenged the petition as being frivolous. And the trial court twice denied their motion for sanctions. So this is also not the case where there was a frivolous filing. We've submitted affidavits establishing facts that established jurisdiction in Texas. She submitted an affidavit 2 days before the special appearance hearing denying some of those facts and adding additional factual allegations. There was a dispute over certain facts. For example, even in their appellate brief, they state that she always worked for a California company, that she contracted with a California company. However, in reality, and we submitted an affidavit and corporate records showing that, that by the time she was negotiating her severance agreement, the company had already moved to Texas. The headquarters had moved to Texas. She knew about that because it was announced company-wide. So her communications related to the severance agreements, at least partially, were with Texas employees. She also sent a demand for a substantial sum of money, saying that she still wanted to bring a discrimination claim. She sent that to a company based in Texas. So those are the facts that we alleged. I understand they disagree with some of the facts, but this was not a frivolous filing. And so if this court were to enter or decide in favor of Ms. Grace, we believe that this will create actually a chilling effect on the ability of Texas companies that have a good faith case for personal jurisdiction for bringing lawsuits in this jurisdiction. I also would like to go back to the question of whether this is affirmative relief that she's seeking, or it's some sort of a recourse, or as they argue in their brief, there's a distinction between substantive and procedural types of reliefs. The reality is the Texas Supreme Court has held and has found in Villafani versus Trejo, which is 251 Southwest 3rd, 466, that a sanction request can be affirmative relief, especially if it seeks monetary award as a way to compensate or punish a party. And in their motion for sanctions, that's exactly what they're seeking, is relief. Even they titled that portion of their motion for sanctions is a monetary award to compensate them for having to respond to the lawsuit. The Supreme Court in Villafani v. Trejo said a sanction can be procedural if it, for example, excludes documents or witness as a form of punishment, but a monetary reward is a claim for an affirmative relief, and that's what they brought here. And there's also a Texas Fort Worth case of appeals on the same issue that was
just out of curiosity, was Villafani a jurisdictional issue about whether or not there could be a non-suit or what?
It was related to a non-suit, Your Honor.
That's what I thought. Okay.
And the case that I was about to cite from the Texas Fort Worth Court of Appeals also dealt with whether a defendant can bring a motion for sanctions after the plaintiff had not suited the case. But in dicta, the court discusses that a sanction can be a claim for an affirmative relief. And the other thing that the actual test for determining whether a party has waived personal jurisdiction, it's not just whether they're asking for affirmative relief that's inconsistent with the challenge to the personal jurisdiction. It's also whether a party is invoking a question that has something on any other question. If the party is invoking jurisdiction or asking the court to render in judgment on any question other than jurisdiction. And that's very consistent with Rule 120A that allows parties only to appear to challenge special appearance. And here she clearly asked for that. In order for the trial court to grant her the monetary judgment that she's seeking, the trial court had to, first of all, decide whether they wanted to grant that judgment and exercise their discretion, then decide whether there was bad faith or an improper purpose on behalf of the attorneys that filed the lawsuit, then had to decide whether the award of attorney's fees is reasonable and just, and then determine the amount of the award. None of those issues have anything to do with the actual question of whether the court has personal jurisdiction over Ms. Graves.
What indication do you have? We're talking about Rule 128, but Rule 13 is a part of the very same rules promulgated by the Supreme Court. What indication do you have from the text of the rule that indicates that the Supreme Court was excluding sanctioned relief under Rule 13, which is similar in kind to Chapter 10?
You know, I think that interpretation, if legislature wanted to include motion for sanctions in Rule 128, it would have been there. But the carve out for what the party can do and not waive their special appearance is very defined. And I think if this court were to find in favor of Ms. Graves and agree with her argument that it should be expanded, then it creates uncertainty over what does or does not waive special appearance.
Okay, so we're to interpret 128 as intended by the Supreme Court to exclude any possibility of relief under Rule 13 under the circumstances, because Rule 13 and Chapter 10 are very similar in what they require for relief and why they exist.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court has granted personal jurisdiction and has found that a defendant does not belong in Texas, they cannot use any other rule to get back in court and ask for affirmative relief, which is exactly what Ms. Graves did here.
Okay, you understand that every court, including this court, always have jurisdiction, both subject matter and personal jurisdiction, to determine the court's own jurisdiction. You understand that, right? Okay. So if the court, in inquiring into its own jurisdiction, discovers that its jurisdiction has been improperly invoked, you're saying that Rule 13 is not a viable means by which the court can act in that regard, because there's no such mechanism in 128 itself.
If acting under Rule 13 would be inconsistent with Rule 128, then I don't believe the court can do it.
Okay.
I also, on the public policy argument, I just wanted to point out that the courts have held that each state has an interest in allowing their citizens to pursue wrongs committed by citizens of other states. So to the extent that public policy is a consideration for this court, we would argue that that interest, coupled with the public policy expressed in Texas Lawyers Creed, requires that Ms. Graves does not prevail today. Mr. Gomez did not address forum nonconvenience argument, but he made it in his brief, so I will briefly respond and state that that issue was not raised at the trial court level and was not part of the court's decision. It was not argued and it was not briefed prior to the court's decision and should not be considered today by the court. And unless you have questions, I will yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
You have any questions? All right. Thank you, counsel.
I'll be very brief, Your Honor. Justice Birdwell, you
raised a very important issue with regard to Rule 13. And in Rule 13, that specific issue was decided in Brady v. Cain, where in that case, the Brady Cain filed a Rule 13 motion for sanctions against Brady based upon those findings.
You do understand that we are always loath to follow any determination by our brethren and sister and over across the county line, do you not?
No, I didn't know that. Okay. I apologize.
Just want to make sure.
In California, we cross so many different lines with different courts and jurisdictions that we're always trying to impose one court upon the other court. My whole purpose of raising that issue, Your Honor, is Rule 13 is analogous to Rule 10. And the purpose of these rules for sanctions, in order for them to have teeth, there has to be recourse. And if the recourse has to be the applicability of the rules 10 and 13, it has to be applied equally and not disparately based upon a person bringing a special appearance. And so, we respectfully request that this court reverse remand and make the finding that there was no waiver of special jurisdiction in this case. We submit. Thank you, Your Honors. Any questions?
I don't believe so. Thank you very much. I will say this for the panel. It's nice to get back in the saddle. This is my first oral argument, I think, Justice Wallach's first oral argument, and he was on a panel this morning, and it was a very good argument. I really do appreciate it. Sometimes we get a procedural matter, and we're like, I'm going to be snoring before the time is up, but both arguments were well made, and we appreciate it, and the case has now been submitted. Thank you all very much.